Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The year after Christopher Columbus's 1492 expedition, Pope Alexander VI issued a papal bull known as the Doctrine of Discovery that gave European explorers the right to discover all lands not inhabited by Christians. The subsequent forced disappearance of native people and their culture continued over the centuries. In more recent history, thousands of native children were forced into Indian boarding schools, whose directive was kill the Indian, save the man, and the 1965 Indian Relocation Act that urged American Indians to leave the reservations and assimilate into urban America. The impacts of colonization are still felt today by the native population. We're talking today with Maya Soto and Sabrina San Miguel, Community Engagement Coordinator and Director of Development and Communications, respectively, for the San Antonio-based nonprofit American Indians in Texas at the Spanish Colonial Missions, AITSCM. The group has embarked on a Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and People, or MMIWP, campaign. Maya Soto says the disproportionate rates of violence against indigenous women in particular has roots in our colonial past and subsequent government actions.
And these are just some examples of past historic things that people may not see as necessarily relevant to the conversation today, but like I said, that have laid the foundation of a culture of white supremacy and violence in this country and in this state that allow for these widely disproportionate numbers of violence that is committed against Native women, Native girls, Native people. And one of the important things that I think needs to be acknowledged is that when we talk about this issue, there is a huge data and research gap. So a lot of the information that, you know, is accessible to the public is outdated at this point. And unfortunately, I think it's safe to assume, right, that these numbers are only growing because there isn't collective action taking place at the, you know, legislative level here in the United States. You know, there are some states that are serving as excellent examples with task forces and things of that nature, right? Minnesota and North Dakota. North Dakota having just recently introduced a statewide task force on this issue. But with all of that being said, according to the National Crime Information Center, in 2016, there were 5,712 cases of missing and murdered Indigenous people reported, and only 2% of these cases were logged into the U.S. Department of Justice Missing Persons Database. Mm-hmm. And this really does speak to that data gap that I was mentioning. And another astounding, you know, number here is that murder is the third leading cause of death for Indigenous women, both on reservation land and in urban settings. And this is so disproportionate when we look at, you know, other ethnic backgrounds and racial backgrounds for women in the United States. And then to get a little bit more specific about some of these urban specific statistics, you know, I think the Urban Indian Health Institute is an excellent resource, and they released a report. I think they started collecting data for the report in 2017 and that it was not released that same year. But around then, the Urban Indian Health Institute created and published a report on the cause and the impact, right, of missing and murdered Indigenous women and people in urban cities. And they attempted to collect data from 71 cities across the United States, including San Antonio, Dallas, Houston, and Arlington. And of these, you know, more than 500 cases, 25% of the cases were listed as missing persons, 56% were listed as murder cases, and a whole whopping 19% had a status of unknown. So these are cases that just entirely fell through the cracks. It's important to note, you know, as well, that 83% of the perpetrators in these 500 plus cases were men, and over 50% of them were non-Native. That's something you hear a lot, right? Native on Native crime. And this is a perfect example of the reality that it is not just Native on Native crime. I do want to say, too, it 28% of these perpetrators were never found guilty or held accountable. And these are just 500 plus cases that were identified in this report, in this study. There are so many cases that are never reported that, you know, fall through the cracks even more. And there's just no record that there's ever been a missing persons case reported or a police report filed. I think it's important to note as well, you know, according to this same study, more than 95% of the identified cases in this study were never covered by national or international media. Mm-hmm. And this is another huge issue when we talk about this topic. There is so much silence, not only from community members, from law enforcement officials, from, you know, government officials, but also from the media. And so I want to take that like as a little moment to just say thank you for having us on and for being willing to discuss this topic.
Well, sort of going on what you just mentioned, you know, nobody can see us just nodding our heads in agreement yes. to everything that you're just saying, because it is definitely a bias of media that when there is a person who goes missing, more often than not in every case, obviously, but more often than not, it will be the media's focus to highlight a white, attractive young woman who has gone missing. And there was a recent missing persons case that is still ongoing here in the San Antonio region that was high profile, and it involves a wealthy white woman who is assumed to be murdered. And when I heard that, and I thought there are so many other women and children and men and most often people of color who are missing, and you don't hear a peep about them because they don't have that high profile. So I'm wondering if, Sabrina, you can comment on that.
I remember reading up on these things, you know, years ago when I was like in my early 20s. And I think that as important and crucial as the MMIWP work and like our campaign is, it's important to note also that we also care about the other people of color, women of color, who are facing the exact same things and the same violence and not getting airtime, you know, that news time, that are not getting the same attention. You know, we're all in this together. And so if one of us isn't free, you know, none of us are free. If one of us isn't safe, none of us are safe. And especially us being in the location that we are, we're in a historically Black neighborhood.
On your offices, side, you mean?
Yes, our office, AIT. The maternal mortality rate alone on the east side is just alarming. It is alarming.
And for the whole state, it's not great either.
Absolutely, yes. And so it's, you know, all of these things matter. All of these, you know, these numbers, these statistics matter. And so, yes, I agree. I think it's important to note that.
Again, talking about statistics, I mean, Maya was reading some really important statistics, and it seems like it may be more difficult now under this current administration to be able to gather this kind of information because there are so many departments and grants and agencies that focus on civil rights that are being cut. And if they're not being cut, their goals are being readjusted in order to sort of, I could use the word whitewash, but to, you know, erase the very important issues that people encounter when it comes to race, ethnicity, poverty, gender. I mean, it seems like it may be more difficult now to gather the kind of information that Maya was talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, we just had my executive director and I, Ramon Vasquez at American Indians in Texas. We just had this really long, serious conversation with our leadership team about how essentially, as you know, like nonprofits are being targeted as terrorist groups and, you know, that really violent language that's being thrown around with, you know, DEI initiatives and the work that we do as an organization. It's such a frightening time as an organization that is quite literally founded on diversity, equity, and inclusion. We are a Native American nonprofit, and the communities we serve, all of that aligns with all of the DEI initiatives that they're speaking about and talking about, like I said, in such a violent language. And so we've had this like long-winded conversation and like really sat down together and got serious about how what we should do to protect our organization and to make sure that we can continue to do this work with our community. And a lot of that had to do around language and had to do around like, okay, are we going to change out our entire website and take out these like hot button words, women, indigenous, like our organization, you know, is a Native American nonprofit. So we're in a place where we're quite honestly just unsure and a little fearful just because we can't stop programs. We can't stop serving our community. When there was that initial like federal funding freeze and they were talking about food stamps getting cut off, in just that weekend alone, we had an increase of like, I want to say, and don't quote me on this, but I want to say it was like we had 60 new people, 60. So 60 new people reach out for services because we provide diapers and other resources at our nonprofit. They were reaching out about food and other things because they got so frightened. We don't get that amount of just new clients in general in just 2 days. And so, like I said, it's a little bit of a frightening time. We're doing our best to navigate it, to essentially kind of stay under the radar so we're not picked on, you know, when it comes to the mission that we have and the work that we do. We're really trying to hone in on, like I said, getting creative, working with other nonprofits with similar missions, other BIPOC communities, organizations in general, and really just trying to come together and be a community and do things and stand together, you know, with our missions and just hope for the best and, you know, hopefully we get support as needed. It's really challenging to see a lot of the funding freezes. And like I said, grants that we thought we were going to get or that we were hoping to apply for kind of just disappear. And so we're going back to the drawing table. We're like, okay, that's okay. What else can we do? How else can we continue to serve our community? Whether that be, you know, if the public can just simply share flyers and stuff off of social media. You know, it doesn't have to be just money for us. Like if anyone wants to donate things to us, like we want to make sure that first and foremost, our community is safe and that we can continue to provide resources and do our work.
Sabrina San Miguel is Director of Development and Communications with the American Indians in Texas at the Spanish Colonial Missions. Maya Soto is AITSCM's Community Engagement Coordinator. We're talking about the MMIWP campaign, raising awareness of missing and murdered Indigenous women and people. When we come back, Indigenous women and girls learn early in life about the very real danger of violence.
It is emotional labor, like, to carry these stories, but we do so because it's our duty, you know, as women in the positions that we are in our organization, in the community.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The rates of violence against Native women are 2.5 times higher than any other group of women in the U.S. 4 in 5 Indigenous women have experienced some type of violence. More than 56% of them experienced sexual violence. At least 5,700 Indigenous women have been reported missing as of 2016. The data is not entirely accurate due to inadequate tracking systems across all levels of government. To hear the statistics, though, is one thing. To hear their stories and know their names is another. We're talking today about the campaign to raise awareness about missing and murdered Indigenous women and people, MMIWP. Sabrina San Miguel is Director of Development and Communications with the San Antonio nonprofit American Indians in Texas at the Spanish Colonial Missions. Maya Soto is AITSCM's Community Engagement Coordinator. Soto says personifying the numbers is the first step to justice.
I wanted to take a moment to highlight an active case here in the state of Texas. The organization MMIW Texas Rematriate is really assisting the family in this particular case. But the person who's missing, her name is Sarah Isabel Martinez. She's missing from Fort Worth, Texas, and was last seen on December 29th, 2024 at 1:30 in the morning. She's Navajo and Hispanic, 17 years old, approximately 5'2 and 100 pounds. And I want to uplift that case and also want to share, you know, a little bit about my own experience in this work and speak to exactly what it is that you were bringing up. I was working on a project, an educational project on the topic of missing and murdered Indigenous women and people a little bit over a year ago. I was specifically doing a case study on Tina Fontaine, who was a young teenage girl who went missing in Canada, actually, but her case really spurred a lot of movement on an international level because of her age and also because she was in the custody of law enforcement, of Child Protective Services, and of medical facilities 24 hours before she was murdered. So the question with this case really became, like, where did all of these systems go wrong?
Right.
This spurred for me this project that I was working on, this educational project, and I spent so much time on this project trying to bring the humanizing aspect of this issue to the public, and I would find myself, like, in my office for hours at a time looking through cases and looking at photos of people, of young women, elderly women, young men, elderly men, people of all different ages, all different gender identities. I would find myself there for hours at a time having no idea how much time had gone by. And, you know, realizing, like, oh my God, I haven't eaten, I haven't had any water. And it can be a real rabbit hole when you start to talk about, like, that human aspect of this epidemic. I personally, you know, a survivor of sexual violence in my own lifetime, I have been privileged not to have immediate family members go missing or be killed because of this epidemic, but it is something that impacts every Indigenous person everywhere, and especially women and girls, mm-hmm. And members of the LGBTQIA2S+ community. You know, I grew up knowing about this issue and having perhaps, like, a healthy dose of fear instilled mm-hmm. in me, but it is a reality that we all face, you know, and I was talking about this with one of our coworkers, one of our colleagues. This is something that impacts every single one of us, whether or not we are directly touched by this epidemic. And I think that's just really important to highlight.
It's interesting. It makes me think, you hear about the talk that Black mothers and fathers have with their children. It almost seems like you all have the equivalent of that in the Native community.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. No, yeah. That's
I never thought of it that way.
Neither have I. Like, that's really poignant because, yeah, that's exactly how it is. Like, just from personal experience, because we're so enmeshed in it, and it is emotional labor, like, to carry these stories, but we do so because it's our duty, you know, as women in the positions that we are in our organization, in the community, like, even with my own children, you know, when we're in the stores, like, I have, my youngest child is an 8-year-old little girl, and so I start positioning, you know, a lot of our, like, safety conversations with that in mind and always talking about that, like, always making sure, like, she's holding my belt buckle, you know, when we run into HEB, or just being very hyper aware of our surroundings. And then you hear so much about just sex trafficking in general and what that looks like even in San Antonio and Bexar County. And it all ties back to, yes, like, the way that we show up in the world with that fear and kind of paranoia just always looming, and making sure that our children know and are being as aware of their surroundings when they're going out, especially our young girls and women.
Yeah. And I've read studies also that, you know, of intergenerational trauma, where the trauma will carry from generation to generation. This has been scientifically studied. And so it's not just something that's a fiction. And I'm sure that in the work that you all have done, you all have witnessed it. You're personally, Maya.
Yeah, the intergenerational trauma that you're talking about is very real. And it's something that I have absolutely experienced as an individual, and it is something that I have witnessed working with people, whether that's the clients that we serve or our own colleagues, you know. But I wanted to maybe, you know, shift that scope and consider something that I've seen more recently shared on social media. We didn't just inherit intergenerational trauma. We have inherited intergenerational wisdom, intergenerational resilience. Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking, you know, in light of the current administration and the impacts and the implications of that for this work and for our organization, Indigenous people have had to be extremely resilient. That's the only reason why we are still here. Mm-hmm. It feels like a really beautiful culminating moment to be here discussing this with another Indigenous woman, you know, who has had that quote unquote talk that has informed our entire lives and livelihoods as Indigenous women. So I just wanted to say, right, like, yes, from my perspective, this current administration and the current political climate in the state and nationwide as well absolutely is scary and it is concerning. And yes, we have to get creative, but we have that creativity in our blood just as much as we have the trauma in our blood.
You mentioned earlier, Maya, that one incident of this one woman who was in the system, so to speak, and those systems failed her. But it is important, I think, in order to advance sort of these initiatives, to have the backing of state and federal institutions. But those institutions are not necessarily as supported or are functioning as well as they should in order to sort of uplift these issues. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, perhaps, Sabrina, if you can comment on what you think needs to be done in order to have that support from the state, from the government, in order to have, you know, that support system other than just what you're able to do from, you know, the inside, so to speak.
So I think on a, like, at a very basic level, we just need to be able to spread awareness and make people aware of in really accessible language, right? Because a lot of time people throw around jargon or, you know, use these like big words. And for me, as someone who studied language and English and who is the storyteller of, you know, our organization, our initiatives, just being able to accessibly tell that story to people so that they understand. So that they understand that it's not just a Native issue, it is a community safety issue. And like, once we are able to kind of get everyone on the same page about that, like, these are your neighbors, these are your best friends, sisters, mothers that are going missing, I think that is the most crucial way to just basically start. And then from there, I think it's important to note just the census data about how there's an increase from 2010 to 2020 of Native American and Alaskan residents in Bexar County. Just, you know, those numbers alone, from 3,800 to over 67,000 in the span of a decade. I am looking forward to seeing what the next 10 years look like for us. And with that being said, like, that alone should be enough data to get, at a very basic level, just getting local, you know, city officials and leaders and community members to start taking it seriously and to really invest in urban-specific MMIWP response protocols, culturally rooted services, public campaigns and awareness in city spaces, and just really normalizing, like, what that means and what that looks like.
Well, it makes me think, you're talking about the census. This is kind of a side note, I suppose, but we have now Ancestry.com.
Oh, yeah.
And people are finding out that they have, you know, 2% Native roots. And perhaps that's what's making them, because the censuses change, right? So the last census, I believe 2020, there were many, many more categories within it where people could choose more than one, especially if they were mixed race. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering if perhaps these sort of ancestry type sites might be encouraging people to mark that they have Native ancestry. And maybe that's why the numbers jump so exponentially.
I would like to speak to that. I think that the possibility is there. I definitely would not rule that out. And I don't have the census data in front of me here right now. You know, off the top of my head, right? Don't quote me on these numbers. I do believe that over 100 different tribal nations were listed as, you know, the specific ethnic or racial identities of these 67,000 plus community members in Bexar County in this most recent census. Those tribal identities that were listed are from all over this country. And just a few of them, you know, off the top of my head, right? Like we have the more local or regional tribes, but then there were also, you know, Lakota, Dakota, Diné, Navajo, you know, and many more tribal affiliations that were listed. And so I think it is an interesting question, right? And, you know, I feel like it opens almost a whole can of beans in a way. You know, but I think that there, the potential exists that there is some validity to that, but I don't think that that's the only cause.
Maya Soto is Community Engagement Coordinator with the San Antonio-based nonprofit American Indians in Texas at the Spanish Colonial Missions. We also spoke with Sabrina San Miguel, AITSCM's Director of Development and Communications. AITSCM recently held a week of action during which the city of San Antonio declared May 5th as a day of awareness for MMIWP, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and People. AITSCM has also launched the San Antonio Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and People Coalition, a grassroots organizing body to advocate for awareness and justice across the region. The organization has set a May 31st deadline to raise $10,000 to support its Pilam Taptayi initiative, which operates the MMIWP Coalition. Find out how to help at tpr.org. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Marian Navarro. Our executive producer is Dan Katz. Our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Hear past episodes at tpr.org and on the Fronteras podcast. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thanks for listening.